my first reaction was, well, okay, you know, it's, she's somewhere. You just need some space or some time. She'll turn up.
Gary said to me, Donna, this story is not going to have a happy ending.
As the chief of the Cary Police Department, it is my very sad duty to tell you that the search for our Nancy is over.
Sure, statistics say we should go back and key on the husband, things like that, and we're not going to walk away from that. But at the same time, we're letting the investigation lead us wherever it goes.
She said that at least three times that day, she had said, I hate you, Brad Cooper. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you.
He's been awake on his computer, and when she comes in shortly after midnight, we think they argued and that a fight ensues, and that's when he strangled her.
You need actual evidence to convict, and actual evidence is something that they did not have.
People who had known the couple for years did not jump on this bandwagon to paint this as an abusive relationship.
Not only did they start with an eye toward building a case against Brad, they also started with an eye toward attempting to preserve Nancy's reputation.
And now the police department and the prosecutors are willing to send an innocent man to rot in a dungeon, in essence, for the rest of his life.
If I was hearing this for the first time, would I feel comfortable sending someone to prison for the rest of their life?
This is True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Welcome. Today, we're going to talk about the case of Nancy Cooper, who was killed in 2008. Brad Cooper has been living behind bars since he was arrested in 2008 for the murder of his wife, Nancy Cooper. Was he a violent sociopath who strangled his young wife and dumped her in a drainage ditch? Or was he just an imperfect husband, framed by the very science that made him a top performer in his field of computer telephone networking?
Well, there's a lot to learn from this.
Yes. There are two sides to this story.
Don't we know that?
And there's a history of two people who married, started a family, and had a troubled relationship.
And we'll be talking about that kind of relationship.
Yes. We'll examine this case and the opinions of those involved right after we see what's on tap.
Well, today we have an IPA, Deviant Dales. It's from Oscar Blues Brewery. Now, I am going to do full disclosure and tell you I'm kind of cheating a little because this is a Colorado brewery, but they have a satellite brewery in Brevard, North Carolina. So it is a North Carolina beer.
Okay, that's good.
The color is kind of an orangey amber color. It's got a nice thick tan head, but it goes away pretty quickly. Leaves behind some nice patterns of lace on the glass. The aroma is kind of floral, and everyone's favorite word these days in describing hops, dank. It's got some sweet malt aroma. Fairly hoppy beer. Grapefruit rind, little caramel. Pretty smooth beer, nice to drink. I'll give it about a 4 out of 5.
All right. Very good. I thought we were using a 1 to 10 scale. Are we changing?
Oh, did you want a 1 to 10? Then I'll give it a...
I think you gave it an 8. You were doing 8s.
I'll give it an 8.5 out of 10.
Okay. That's good. Okay. So now, how about if we scoot our stools down to the quiet end of the bar and try to find out who killed Nancy Cooper?
It's going to be a tough one. I'm vacillating.
I know. There's a lot to talk about. So, Nancy Rentz was born on October 25th, 1973. She was an identical twin with her sister, Krista. She also had a brother, Jeff, and a younger sister, Jill. Now, Nancy met Brad Cooper in Calgary, Canada in 1998, when she was just 24 years old. Now, when he was offered a prestigious position by Cisco Systems in Raleigh, North Carolina, Brad wanted Nancy to move there with him. So they kind of rushed along getting married. They got married for immigration reasons. She could move with him, although everyone says they would have gotten married anyway, in the fall of 2002. So they got married. They moved to North Carolina. And over those next 8 years, they had two children, one in 2004, one in 2006. Made friends. They each had a BMW in the driveway. and Brad's career was flourishing. He became an expert in the field of internet technology and telephones, and he was actually one of only 152 internetwork experts in the whole world at that time.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
You know, you had mentioned that they moved to the United States and they got married because she needed to in order to be in the U.S. as
right.
a Canadian citizen, or at least spend time in the U.S. I guess you can certainly obviously visit as a Canadian citizen, but you can't live there. So I'm thinking in light of all the difficulties that they had down the road,
mm-hmm.
maybe they did marry in haste. And if they had continued to date, they might not have ever gotten married.
Well, sure, yeah.
That's just a supposition.
Mm-hmm. That definitely could be part of the reason why the marriage didn't work out very well.
I'm just wondering, yeah.
But at the time they moved, everyone thought they were in love and everything was going to be great.
Sure, they're still in the first throes of love.
Right, the honeymoon stage.
Right.
Now, neighbors and friends in North Carolina, they said Nancy was a loving, hands-on kind of mother, spent a lot of time playing with her kids on the playground and stuff. She didn't have a job, but she really couldn't because she didn't have a permit to work in the U.S.,
Yeah.
She's still a Canadian citizen, of course.
So she could work kind of under the table and get paid that way. But I guess she didn't work at all.
No, not really. But she had these two kids, so
yeah.
That's a lot there.
That's work, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So now Brad and Nancy Cooper, they lived in Raleigh, North Carolina, suburb Cary, with their two young daughters, Bella and Katie. And it was on Saturday, July 12th, 2008, at 10 a.m. when Nancy's friend Hannah called the Cooper house. Brad answered, and he said Nancy'd left for a run at 6:30 or 7. Hannah was supposed to meet up with Nancy at her house around 9-ish, and she wasn't back. So Nancy not showing up or calling Hannah was unlike her, and it did ring a little bell in Anna's head.
Right.
It's
Hannah.
Hannah.
Yeah, there's the first inkling that something's not right, and if she's made a date to be at her friend's house for coffee or whatever at a certain hour. And from what I understand, she always let people know what was going on, where she was, what she was doing. It's 10 o'clock, hasn't heard from her. So mm-hmm. you start worrying a little bit.
Worrying a little. It's a red flag, but, now nothing to panic about at that point.
Right.
Now at 1 p.m., Hannah's phone rings, and the caller ID says the Cooper's home number. So she assumes it's Nancy, and she answers, happily, "Where the heck are you?" And it's not Nancy, though. It's Brad. Now, Nancy still hadn't returned from her run, he said.
So
and Brad was getting worried. Yeah.
Yeah. This is like, it's 1 in the afternoon, so it's maybe like 4 hours after she was supposed to have shown up.
6, maybe. Well, 6 hours since she left the house, according to Brad.
Right. She's supposed to be back around 9 to have coffee.
Yeah, right. So. 4 hours. Yep, you're right.
So, yeah. Now there's big red flags going
mm-hmm.
up. I guess what they did, they started calling around and seeing if they could find her. They called the local hospitals. No Nancy in any of the hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Brad or Hannah or both called Nancy's twin sister in Canada. She
Krista.
Hadn't heard from her either. Krista called her brother, who was a policeman in Edmonton, Alberta.
Yeah, Jeff.
And he kind of downplayed it, I guess, a little bit. Said that she'll turn up eventually.
Yeah, well, she's an adult, so he's thinking she'll turn up.
Mm-hmm.
You have no reason to think otherwise, really. Then when Nancy's parents, Gary and Donna, they hear the news from Krista, and they panic pretty early on, and they kind of think the worst, that something bad's happened, because where would she be? Gary says to Donna, "This story's not going to have a happy ending."
Yeah.
It's weird.
That's really weird. I mean, here they've just heard that she's gone missing a little bit, not even that long, and he's already thinking the worst.
Yeah.
So maybe he knows something.
Well, it might be related to the troubled marriage, I don't know. But it's quite a thing to say right off the bat.
Boy, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So it's that afternoon they contact the police because they haven't found her, and Nancy's family comes out to Cary to help search with volunteers. They searched the trails and the woods where Nancy liked to train, and Brad made a public plea for help on the local television. Even though she was from Canada, she did have a lot of friends, so there was quite a turnout looking for her, a lot of volunteers.
Do Canadians generally not have friends? You say even though she was from Canada?
No, not because she's Canadian, but because she's new. Because she's kind of new to the area.
Okay.
She made friends quickly, I guess, is what you think.
It sounded like they fit in pretty nicely with their group of friends and did stuff together.
At least Nancy did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're looking for her. They don't find her. And then it's Monday, 2 days later, July 14th, that a man walking his dog calls 911.
Not sounding good already.
No. So Nancy's found dead in a storm drain near a housing construction site. And that's several miles away from her home. And now we have a homicide investigation.
So how far did Nancy like to run usually? Is this out of her range? If she's several miles from home, do you think that she was there running?
I think it's out of her range because I think she ran trails around. So I don't think she necessarily went a long distance away.
So you'd be thinking that she was taken there?
Yeah.
And not that she had been running there?
Probably not. The detective in charge is George Daniels. And then we find out she wasn't raped. There were no signs of sexual assault. No sperm was found.
I would just say, and we heard some other people echo the same thing, the fact that no sperm was found does not necessarily mean that she wasn't raped.
Right. You mean other acts were performed on her?
Well, you could. And you could even have vaginal penetration without showing much outward signs of anything.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, there's no sperm.
Right. And then she's still wearing her diamond earrings. Those weren't taken, so that makes you wonder a little bit.
So less likely to be a robbery.
Right. She's wearing only her sports bra, otherwise she's naked.
Yeah.
And they do determine that she was strangled. You looked at that autopsy report. Was there anything else on that you found significant?
Nope, she was asphyxiated because she was strangled. And they found a breakage of the neck bone that commonly gets broken with strangulation, the hyoid bone.
Okay.
So there wasn't anything else remarkable about the autopsy.
Okay.
Although now if I'm a policeman, I'm thinking, doesn't look like there was a rape. Doesn't look like there was a robbery. So I'm thinking maybe it was more of a person she knew. Or more of a anger type thing.
Right. Which kind of makes you look at the husband right there, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
again, I'm a policeman. I'm going to think right away. This doesn't look like a stranger attack. It looks like an acquaintance attack.
Right. And where are her clothes? So it must have happened somewhere else because her clothes aren't there.
That's right.
Just the sports bra. And there are no signs of a struggle there. There's not like disturbed earth or anything. They didn't find any DNA under her nails. So it kind of seems like something happened to her somewhere else and she was brought there.
Right.
Yeah. So she's face down in a storm drain. It's awful. And there are no signs of a struggle. Now, witnesses did report seeing her running that morning in the neighborhood within a couple of miles of her home.
In the neighborhood, not out where she was found.
No. No. That was a little more remote. It was down the end of a cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
Yeah, where I don't think the houses were finished. They weren't being lived in yet. It was a construction area for a housing complex.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, the aerial photo we saw looked like it was pretty deserted.
Yes.
I mean, you could see the cul-de-sac, the road in the cul-de-sac, but I didn't see a lot of houses out there.
No. So, of course, they interviewed Brad, and they found out about the marital problems at that point, that Brad had an affair, that he thought the marriage had been getting better, he said. But Nancy's family disagreed. It turns out that Nancy and Brad had agreed to separate not too long before this happened. And Nancy's lawyer sent over a separation agreement with the final figures for alimony, child support, and all that paperwork came to Brad. And once he saw that, he changed his mind. He had agreed to let Nancy and the kids move back to Canada. But once he saw the agreement, he wouldn't allow them to move back to Canada with the girls.
And that was all a money issue. He didn't want to spend that much money.
Well, there are different sides. The accusing side, the prosecution, says it was the money. But Brad's supporters say also that he wouldn't have seen his girls very often up there. You know, the visitations were not very often.
That would be true.
And it was a lot of money. Private schools, everything. He was paying for everything for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but he's this whiz kid who's probably making a lot of money.
Yeah, but as we'll find out a little down the road, they were in a lot of debt, too. They weren't really doing that well financially.
Yeah, it looked like they were living above their means.
They were spending like crazy. So he wouldn't allow her to move back to Canada with the girls. Of course, that caused more friction between them, and they're still in the same house together. He said that that wasn't enough time with his daughters. And then after she was found dead, his sister-in-law, Nancy's twin sister, called Brad. And she said, "What have you done to her?" And then hung up on him, didn't want to hear what he had to say about that. So the family, I think, right away suspected him.
So her side of the family thinks the worst of him.
Yeah, they actually did an emergency court appearance filing for custody, temporary custody of the children, as soon as it was determined to be a homicide, even though Brad was not a suspect at that time. So they got custody of the kids, and a lot of Brad's supporters believe that him losing custody really made him look guilty in front of the public.
Well, it sure doesn't make you look good. I mean, he hasn't even been charged with anything yet.
No.
And a judge awards custody of his children to his in-laws.
Because they say the kids are in danger. Though there's no evidence of abuse or anything in the household.
Right. I wonder what was testified before the judge and why he granted the grandparents custody.
Yeah, that we don't know. Those are all filed away. We don't know what happened exactly.
I mean, I would think it'd be bad enough, whatever it is.
Right. Well, I don't know. Now, Nancy's new friends in North Carolina said that she was complaining because Brad was very controlling and had put Nancy on a $300 a week allowance. Now, that wasn't for bills. It was for groceries and spending money every week. So, it's fairly generous. It's not a lot of money, but it's certainly not being deprived. They tried to say that, the prosecution tried to say that it was domestic violence to control the money like that, to control her, and that she was deprived of the things she needed, which doesn't seem to be true at all from what we can tell.
Well, $300 for groceries, I mean, a family of four, granted two little kids, but I'll bet $150, $200 of that is groceries.
Mm-hmm.
So it leaves you $100 or so left to do what else?
Shop, get coffee, stuff like that.
Right. And then I'm not sure who's paying the bills. I guess nobody, because they're deeply in debt.
Well, he's paying the bills. You know, well, he's paying them kind of late, but he is paying the bills.
Yeah, didn't he have like a $45,000 debt on Amex?
Well, yeah, that's what he told the police, why he had her on the allowance, because of their debt. Amex was like $47,000.
That's a ton.
And almost 30 of that was what she had done in 1 year. I don't think that a lot of husbands would be very happy, or wives, if their spouse was charging that much money.
No, for sure.
Yeah. Now, he did admit to having an affair with Nancy's best friend, Heather. Of course, that didn't make him look good either.
Her ex-best friend, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and he said initially that it was only a one-time deal. It didn't mean anything.
Yeah. That's what he finally admitted to. And then when they went to marriage counseling, it came out that it had been a long-term affair. But, you know, this Heather got around, as we'll find out later.
Yes, she did.
She was a busy girl.
She was a player.
Yeah. So the Friday night before Nancy disappeared, Brad and Nancy were actually at a party across the street with their neighbors. Brad left it early, like at 8, and Nancy stayed until midnight with her friends and came home. And according to Brad, oh, go ahead.
Well, I know they're having marital troubles, so maybe that's not so unusual. But I think if I'm at a neighborhood party, we come as a family, we leave as a family.
Mm-hmm.
And he left a few hours before she did.
Yeah, well, according to her friends, they were having some difficulties, and Nancy was kind of, you know, rebelling against it and kind of going out with her friends and doing things away from the family more than she initially did.
Yeah. So she said, okay, you can go home, take the kids home.
Yep.
I'm staying here for a while.
Yep. According to Brad, they were up at 4 a.m. Saturday morning with their baby Katie because she was crying and not really being consoled. And Brad went to the grocery store. He ended up going two times early that morning for milk and then for laundry detergent.
So he picked up the milk, came home.
Headed home. And got a call at around 6:40 from Nancy saying they needed laundry detergent and juice, too.
Okay. So back he goes.
Yeah. And this call will come up later as a subject that is much disputed.
Oh, this is the call.
This is the call.
So he's got his milk. He's ready to come home. Whoops. Wife is calling me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to pick up the other stuff and then go home. So he goes home.
Mm-hmm.
And she's already left because she's out on her run.
No, she's there. He's upstairs giving the girl her bottle, the baby girl her bottle, and looking at some emails or something.
Oh.
And she calls out to him, or she just leaves and shuts the door. He can't remember for sure that she went out for a run around 6:30 or 7. Must be closer to 7 because the call was at 6:30, 6:40. So around 7-ish, she went out for a run, he said.
Okay.
He says that's the last time he saw her.
So he got home and she was there.
Mm-hmm.
And were the kids both up? Did anyone else see her at home before she went for her
yeah,
run?
I think the 4-year-old did say she saw her mom that morning. Yeah, good point. She did. And then we also had witnesses that said they saw her running, as I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Now...
But then we're getting back into my favorite topic, the eyewitness.
Yes, I know.
And you know how reliable they are.
I know.
But...
But when you compare it to the husband's story, the eyewitness story, I think they're kind of on the same ground as far as which do you believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think so. I mean, if the husband says he got home and she left shortly after he returned home for her run and people saw her out for her run, that's good, mm-hmm. at least in terms of the husband.
Right. Now, it was about two and a half years after her death that Brad was put on trial for her murder. Now, what were Brad's motives?
Well, I can think of some.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting divorced.
Well, they're not necessarily getting divorced. They were getting separated.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's having an affair, which I'll bet was an ongoing thing.
It was, yeah.
Despite his protestation. And this is a way to get rid of the wife.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to do her in. So I can see where he'd be the prime suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Except he's got an alibi of sorts.
Of sorts. Now, the prosecution said that his financial control, they said it was domestic violence to control someone financially like that.
All right.
So I don't know about that. I don't know. What do you think of that? I mean, if you're not hitting someone or, you know, verbally degrading them, is holding the money really domestic violence?
Well, I think that's kind of playing with semantics. I think it is a form of abuse.
Really?
To withhold money.
And even if you have food and a nice house and all your needs are taken care of, you're just withholding spending money?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Okay.
I think that maybe there could have been more money or not that she had to have an allowance. I think that's a portrait of him being controlling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. It definitely shows him as controlling. And neighbors, witnesses, they did say that Nancy and Brad fought openly at the Friday night party the day before she disappeared. They said Brad went home at 8. She didn't go home until midnight. The prosecution's idea was that she came home at midnight, they had a fight, and he strangled her that night. And that she never went out running in the morning.
Okay.
And that he drove to the store.
And he disposed of her body at some point.
At some point.
Must have been in the nighttime though, right?
Yeah. I would think so. They think he made the trips to the store just so he'd be on the video camera.
Okay, so he's got an alibi.
Mm-hmm. And they think that he had the expertise to rig that call that came from the home phone to his cell phone, even if Nancy was already dead.
Yeah, I'll bet he did. I'm sure he had the expertise to do that. I mean, again, he's this hotshot telecommunications guy.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been, to me, it would have been child's play for him to rig that to his advantage.
Well, the prosecutor agrees with you. He said that Brad made the call from the computer modem. He'd actually had a router from the office that he had at home, although they never found it afterwards. But because he was a computer telephone network expert, they do think that he could do that.
Sure.
Now, on the defense side, they really never, during the trial, they never really were able to prove that he had done it. The prosecutor said that Brad rigged the call from the home phone to the cell phone, and he had some experts. The prosecution had experts come in, and they testified on multiple ways that it might have worked, but there was never any evidence found that he actually did do it.
So it's all supposition, and it's all this is how we think he could have done it.
Right.
But they couldn't find any hard facts to back that up.
It's not proof, and actually the defense found some experts of their own who said that the maximum length of a router call with that method that he might have used could only be 23 seconds. And the call was 32 seconds that was made from the home to Brad that morning.
So the defense says there's no way that could have happened.
That's right. But the thing about that is that the defense computer experts were never heard by the jury during his trial.
No, they were excluded?
They were. Judge Paul Gessner precluded the testimony of Jay Ward, who was a network security expert, and Giovanni Mascucci, a computer forensic expert. Now, the former was because they said that he was not enough of an expert in the telecommunications field.
Okay.
And the forensics expert, they said that he was not entered in for the case soon enough. It was too late to add him in, which I'm not sure how that works.
Me either. I mean, I can see where they could exclude the guy who's claiming to be an expert and not an expert.
Right.
Because that's like me testifying about telecommunications.
Yeah, but usually once you get them on the stand, you can show that they're not competent, I thought.
Yeah, well, that's true. But maybe they just figured it was a waste of time to even put them on the stand.
Well, maybe.
So we'll exclude his testimony, their testimony.
No, another really funky thing is that the prosecution actually said it would jeopardize national security if the FBI shared tools and underlying notations in which they formed their opinion about his Google Maps search. Now,
what's the Google Maps search? You haven't mentioned that yet.
Oh yeah, the Google Maps search. Well, that's another thing that the computer experts were going to testify on. So let's go back to where we were and we'll get around to that.
Okay.
I got a little ahead of us there. So Brad said that he went to bed at 9:30 p.m. the night before. And another thing that conflicted that on the computer was that it showed that someone was online until after midnight on the computer. So a lot of computer things come into this. That's one.
Well, maybe it was the four-year-old.
Yeah, probably. Isn't that what child porn is? It's when little kids get up late at night
and
go on the computer.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's probably what would be porn for a child. Really good toys, Legos, candy,
Legos,
ice cream.
Maybe little naked dinosaurs or something.
Yeah, that could have been it.
Yeah.
Okay. So the Google Maps search, now we're there. At 1:15 p.m. on Friday, July 11th, the day before she disappeared, there was a Google Maps search from Brad's computer. It was a 41-second search to exactly where Nancy's body was found. Now, the defense attorney, H. Kurtz, said no witness ever had any signs of violence ever from Brad, and that when Nancy's friend Jessica said Nancy was supposed to paint her house the morning she disappeared, that Brad's friend said that he was going to play tennis with him, so she would have had to watch the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe her friends are not as reliable as we think. Maybe we should give Brad a little slack here, listen to his friend. Maybe everything they're saying about Nancy's plans for that day and what happened aren't the truth. They're not necessarily the truth.
So they're just trying to mess up the timeline and suggest that he could have had the opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the other thing I'd ask, jumping back and forth here,
right,
is that if this guy's such a computer expert, why would he leave his Google Maps search on the computer?
Exactly. Going to right where the body was found.
You know, you get rid of that.
I would think so. And I know sometimes people can be stupid when they commit crimes, especially in the heat of passion, but the other things they're saying about him are that he planned things out pretty carefully. He was thinking clearly with this whole thing.
Their theory of the wife returning from the party, getting into an argument, getting killed, and he's got the foresight to think up a way to fake a phone call.
Right.
And
get rid of the router somehow.
Right. I don't see why he wouldn't do something about the search.
The search, and also the being on the internet until midnight if he said he was going to bed at 9:30.
Right. So that's suspicious stuff, because it seems from what we've heard in this case that he was a very careful planning person.
Mm-hmm. Well, FBI experts did testify that Brad did the search of Fielding Drive, which is where her body was found, Friday afternoon before she disappeared. And the problems with this brought up by the defense attorneys were that police took custody on the 15th of July of the home. That was because she was found. So they took custody of the home that afternoon. But they left the computer on and plugged into the internet for greater than 24 hours. And then they stuck it in a lab that did not have signing in for it and signing out for it. All you had to do was be a person that was there with the key, someone, an employee. So chain of custody was broken. Now, chain of custody, some people might not know that that is to prevent access and to contain the accountability for an item.
Sure.
So it was not preserved, and it was also found by the defense experts that files were altered and not authentic. Now, the way they did that was random access memory, which they call a hash, that value would prove that nothing was touched on it after it was taken. So if you ran that and you had that on the motherboard, then you would know that nothing could be done after that, right? That everything you had was legitimate when you took custody of it.
Right.
But they didn't do that until 2 weeks after. Also, timestamps associated with the search were invalid. There were dates that were invalid, like the year 2500 and something. And I guess that means when something like that happens that something's been messed with.
Okay. So the defense is putting out the theory of a big conspiracy.
Well, I guess it's your idea of a big conspiracy, what your idea of a big conspiracy would be.
Well, it sounds like they're postulating that the Google search and the files that were deleted, these were all things done by police or somebody.
Yeah, not necessarily police. Could be family members, friends that were against Brad, because her local friends and family were not happy with him. They all thought that he'd done something to her.
But how, I mean, once the computer's in the custody of the police, the family members can't waltz in and look at the computer.
Well, you would hope not.
No, they can't.
Okay. Well, I've heard of strange things where, like, they let the father in to come in and get some things for the kids, or, you know, Nancy's father or something.
Maybe into the house.
Right. The computer was left in the house for over 24 hours before they took it.
Right.
Yeah.
Part of me thinks, you know, he's not that stupid to do all that stuff to the computer.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part says, this is way too big a conspiracy against Brad. So I'm not sure where I come down on that.
Well, you don't have to come down anywhere. We're still talking.
Okay. I'm still listening.
Yeah. So defense experts did validate that these timestamps were incorrect. And the FBI did not follow up with that. They did not verify it with Google either. I guess there's a privacy policy with Google for 9 months. And then after that, you can't get any information from them. So the third-party validation with the IP address and the time were not shared with the defense.
Because the time had expired. It was over 9 months.
Well, they didn't give it to the defense until 11 months after.
Yeah.
Although the defense had been asking for it way before 9 months. See, so they were kind of holding it.
More conspiracy.
Yeah. And, you know, because the reason they're holding it could be that it would ruin their case if it was found out. The defense computer experts were not heard by the jury, as I said, for reasons of national security, as well as not filing in for the experts at a certain time or something. And that really, I think they kind of messed things up there. Regardless of if he's guilty or not, they kind of made mistakes there with the case. Another big theory with the defense was that the police focused on Brad from the beginning and were just trying to make him look bad and make Nancy look like a saint. But we did find out that Nancy did have an affair during the marriage, too.
They were both doing it.
Okay. I don't know. Well, they didn't say hers was ongoing, but who knows?
Right.
Right. Now, Nancy had a BlackBerry, because that was the thing back in 2008. And a Cary detective erased the contents of the BlackBerry also. Now, this phone would have her emails, her texts, pictures, videos, Facebook, all that stuff. But the defense never got any access to that. So that seems like another unfair part of this case against Brad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this was intentionally erased?
Well, no, they said it was an accident, but don't worry, we got everything we needed, they said.
And everything they needed they shared with the defense?
What they had, yes.
Okay.
It was not all the things from her phone. It was what the prosecution determined relevant from the phone. And then it was supposed to be turned over to the defense, but then it was accidentally erased, which, not to jump on the conspiracy bandwagon, but to erase a BlackBerry is noted to be a 10-step process where it asks you, are you sure you want to do this more than once?
So you have to be pretty sure you're going to be doing that, because you're going to get all these questions asked, are you sure you want to do this?
Well, I don't know how you could accidentally erase all the data from your phone.
No.
It's a process.
Not if you go through all these steps.
Yeah.
You might go through one or two and then say, oops, I fucked up. I didn't want to do that.
Right. But you would think if you're working for the authorities, getting that kind of evidence, that you should know a little something about a phone as well.
Yeah. So does the defense have an alternative theory as to what happened to Nancy? Or are they...
No, but it's really not their job to do that.
Well, but all this stuff is weighted against their guy, Brad.
True.
So they need to either figure out how to discredit the testimony that's been presented, or bring out an alternative theory. It doesn't look like they're doing a very good job of discrediting the testimony. I know you'll say, well, that's because they were disallowed and they couldn't. But yeah. Heck, they're lawyers. They're smart. They should figure out ways to do it.
Well, I don't know. Of course, he had the tech skill to make the phone call, but there was no proof that he did that. And it was proven that his computer was tampered with. So the 41-second Google Maps search may have been planted also. But that, I think they said the Google Maps search was one of the biggest pieces of evidence against him. If he looked up the place where her body was found the night before, hang him. I mean, that's just...
Oh, yeah. That's for sure.
So that's a big deal.
Very.
And the defense had the two experts, but neither was allowed. For 2 months, the trial went on, and the defense said the erasing of Nancy's phone had to be intentional. They went over how you erase a BlackBerry, and it's really not something you could do by accident, unless you thought you had a different phone that you wanted to erase and you mixed up the phones. I can't see any other way.
That's far-fetched, too.
Yeah. So Detective Daniels said that no one on their staff could have tampered with Brad's computer because they didn't have the skills or the knowledge. That was his only argument to that.
Okay.
And the prosecution said Brad murdered Nancy when she came home Friday night. They had a fight. Mm-hmm. And he strangled her. Then he went out to the store to have an alibi, made up the phone to get an alibi. And then in the morning, he just said that she'd gone for a run and never came back.
Right.
Yeah. But then we did find out about Nancy's affair with John Pearson. That was revealed during the trial. But he was cleared as a suspect because he had an alibi.
And what was his alibi? This is rich.
He spent the night with Nancy's friend Heather.
The woman who Brad was having an affair with.
Right. That's why we said Heather gets around.
She do.
So Brad was found guilty of first-degree murder. That was the crux of that whole trial.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it sure sounds like there's grounds for an appeal.
Yes, there were. And he does appeal, and he wins a new trial because the defense did not allow them to present the computer experts' evidence about the computer and the Google Maps search and the fake phone call, or the, you know, so-called fake phone call.
So they're going to have a new trial where they're going to have their experts show how the computer could have been tampered with and how the phone call could be faked.
Yes, yeah. Or why it wasn't faked.
Or why it wasn't faked.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
So that's supposed to be allowed in the new trial.
We're talking about Brad's team.
So even then, I was watching news coverage from that time and was really surprised to see that even Nancy Grace agreed that Brad should get a new trial.
And we know she's a hard ass.
She is. Well, of course she said it won't make any difference. He's guilty.
Yes, she did. She did. But she thought that he deserved a new trial because of the not allowing the evidence.
Yeah, I think if Nancy Grace is going to give you some slack, there's probably a good point there. Why? Because she's not very nice to defendants.
Nope, she's a real prosecutor.
Yes, she is. So the appeals court did award the new trial, and then the state appealed that, but the appeal courts upheld their finding that he does deserve a new trial, and that was granted. But there were some troubles with that for Brad, too.
What were those?
Well, with the new trial, his attorney was court-appointed. He didn't have the money or the resources to get a private attorney at this point.
Okay.
And they also...
I sure would have figured out a way to pay for a private attorney.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you can't, you can't. And many of Brad's supporters feel that this attorney was unqualified. Now, he was also given the same judge that was in the first trial. Now, this judge had been held accountable for messing up the first trial, but then with his new trial, he's appointed the same judge.
Yeah, how's that happen?
I don't know.
I would think the judge would recuse himself from the second trial, from the appeal, just because he got overturned on the first trial. Why would you go back for seconds?
Well, there's all funny stuff going on. The court-appointed attorney wasn't even on the capital offenders list, which is very irregular for a case like this. It's first-degree murder.
So how did he get to be Brad's attorney?
Yeah, good question. He was appointed by the state.
Okay.
And the judge was put on that as well. And I guess the judge didn't want to hand it over. I don't know if it was because it was a high publicity case or if it was because maybe he was angry and wanted to prove himself right. I think that's what Brad was afraid of.
Well, yeah. I'm sitting there with an inexperienced attorney, at least in these types of cases, and I'm staring at the same judge who presided over my first trial.
Same judge, same prosecutors who have said how horrible you are, that you're a murderer. And then you have this attorney, which, I don't know, maybe he tried hard, but he didn't seem qualified. He only visited Brad 2 times in prison during the 9 months leading up to the time of the trial.
Well, he was diligently checking the facts.
Yeah. Right before the trial started, Brad was offered an appeal deal. Now, the appeal deal was made public without talking to Brad or his family. He found out about the appeal deal watching the news that this was going to be offered to him.
So this is something that the attorneys had discussed amongst themselves and decided they'd go ahead with it. And then Brad finds out he hadn't even spoken to his attorney about this.
No, and it's a little disconcerting because if you think your attorney, and these attorneys work together, the prosecutors, the appointed defendant attorneys, they work together day in and day out. They have relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're working out a deal for you and not even discussing it with you, you have to wonder how much is this attorney really going to be on your side if you go to trial.
Quite so.
So when Brad found out about the appeal deal, he did meet with his lawyer. According to the deal, he would have to plead guilty to second-degree murder. And at this time, it's already 2014. So he's been locked up for...
So he's served six years or so.
Yeah. Because he was held during the trial as well.
Right.
And leading up to the trial.
Mm-hmm.
This was 2014. He took the plea deal and he pled guilty to second degree murder and had to serve 6 more years on top of the 6 that he'd served. So we get a total of 12 years.
Now, I think you were watching that clip too, when they asked Brad if he accepted the plea deal.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to. You could tell that.
Yeah, you could.
He's staring at the judge, and then he finally talks with his attorney, because he had to plead guilty. He had to say he was guilty of second-degree murder.
If he wanted the deal.
And yep. He clearly didn't want to do that.
What was that, or take his chances, which his chances don't seem great.
No, I probably would figure I'm innocent, but if I go ahead with this trial, I'm fucked.
Yeah, I don't think so.
That's what they did to me the first time.
Right. Yeah, he's already been in prison a long time. This is a guy who was successful and seemed to have a pretty good life. I'm sure he hadn't seen his children. I'm sure they didn't bring him to visit.
No.
No.
They're up in Canada now, right?
Yes, but I think I did hear that there was an agreement that he could see the children very, very rarely with supervision and have some parental rights if he took the deal. That was part of the deal as well.
Where the kids would come to his prison and visit him, or he... Because he's not going to get let out of prison to go visit his children.
No, after he gets out of prison, he'd be able to see them, I think.
Oh.
Which is a long time.
Well, he's still got another...
it was 2014.
So he's got another four or five years.
Yeah. I don't know. What does that make you think of our justice system?
Well, there's some worrisome things that get brought up.
Yeah, these kind of things make me nervous.
I was all set when I was first looking at this, I figured, okay, he did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the more stuff that gets uncovered, the less likely I think he did it. But then at the same time, I don't have an alternate theory. Mm. You know, I can't believe that she was just snatched off the road while she was running and murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm back to Brad again.
Yeah.
But I'm really ambivalent about it.
Yeah, it's a tough case because I think even if he did do it, I don't think they had the evidence to convict him of doing it.
No.
And a lot of people would say, well, who cares? He did it. He's in prison. That's all that matters. But it makes me worry about how our judicial process works and how many innocent people are.
So can he appeal again, or is he out of appeals?
No, I think once you plead, you're done.
You're done.
Yeah.
So he can't do anything about this now.
No, I think he just has to ride it out, but he's always going to be a convict, you know.
He'll be a felon. A felon. Forever.
Will he ever be able to get any good work?
Probably not.
Who's going to give him access to their computers?
And he's, other than visits with his kids, he's never going to have custody of his kids.
No, and I really don't think those girls are going to like him. I think that living with Nancy's family, although they're probably well-intentioned, I'm sure they love their nieces, their granddaughters, I don't think they're going to tell them anything good about Brad.
No.
No.
No, we've seen that. And sister who's raising them, the twin, says, we'll tell them when the time comes.
Yeah.
So I know what they're going to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
Your daddy killed your mommy.
Right. So there is actually a blog that I looked at called Justice for Brad. And the subtitle reads, in a rush to judgment by the police, a clique of friends, and a community, an innocent man has been accused, tried, and wrongly convicted of first-degree murder. So their overview is that Brad was convicted with tainted computer evidence, and during the course of his 10-week trial, the only evidence against him came from the computer. There was no DNA evidence, no signs of a struggle. There was no mysterious life insurance policy. He was having an affair, but it had been ongoing, and the woman he was having an affair with, as far as we know, didn't want to be with him exclusively or anything, or break up the marriage. She had actually told Nancy that she slept with Brad a while back, even though at that point that Nancy thought it was a one-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury was not allowed to hear those two computer experts, as we said, and even though he got the new trial, that seemed kind of a lost cause, even if they got to bring those computer experts up.
Yeah.
I don't think that was risky. I think I might have taken the plea even if I was innocent.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if you're really innocent, but you know you're going to get life in prison, would you bargain for the 13 years or whatever he's going to serve? I don't know.
Now, according to these supporters, the day that the house was taken custody of, Brad left his home at 5:20 p.m., and from that point on, the IBM ThinkPad was in the sole custody of the Cary Police Department. And instead of following protocol, as I touched upon earlier, Cary Police chose not to analyze the computer's random access memory. They chose not to disconnect the computer from Brad's wireless network, which means things could have been done to it wirelessly. You didn't even have to be there with the computer, which I hadn't thought of earlier.
Right.
Because you know, like, when you're at work, they can go into your computer, you can see the little mouse moving around on its own. Mm-hmm. Those IT people can do that. So they didn't power it down. They knew that the computer was open on the network, but left it on in the home. And Brad's wireless network for over 27 hours. And during those 27 hours, at least 692 files were altered, according to the FBI. Those files included emails, internet history files, stretching over weeks at a time, and key properties of Brad's user profile.
Now, that seems like a pretty daunting task to edit 692 files. I mean, how do they know what they're looking for or anything?
Right. I don't know if they mean by edit that you're doing anything extensive with all those. You know, certain files are connected to other files. You might change the time of something and change a bunch of things.
But what good is that going to do?
Well, it convicted him if he didn't do that search himself.
Well, the search, yeah.
Yeah.
But all these files that were altered.
Mm-hmm. Well, they changed his internet history, which would have made it look like he was on the computer later than he said that night.
Well, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the other 691 things going on?
Well, I think an internet history could have hundreds of things within a few minutes if you're doing things on the computer. Things go quickly.
Okay. I guess I'm not expert enough.
Well, I'm not either, but I can see how that could happen. I can see how files really build up, and it doesn't mean that they're all these separate things. They didn't do 692 separate things.
Okay.
When you change one file, you can change a lot of things. And that's as specific as I can get with my knowledge. But the Cary police were advised by the FBI to ask Google if the search was valid, but they chose not to do that, even though they sent other subpoenas to Google regarding the case. Now, these are all things on Brad's blog, for the blog for Brad. So I have no way of saying whether they're true or not. But these are the things that are listed. So it seems like they didn't really want to find out other things once they had what they wanted.
Yeah, it sounds like pretty sloppy work.
Mm-hmm. We said we'd go down to the end of the bar and try and figure out who killed Nancy Cooper. I guess we only really have the one suspect, Brad Cooper.
I don't have anyone else that I think would have done it, even though it sounds like he kind of got railroaded. I don't know who else I'd suspect.
Well, I think he was a little bit railroaded. In the beginning, the police said that they had no reason to think that this was a random act and that the community shouldn't be frightened. So that just totally points the finger at her husband from the beginning.
Sure. But I can see where they'd say that. I mean, she wasn't robbed, she wasn't raped.
Well, you're the one that said maybe she was raped and they didn't know.
Well, the likelihood that she wasn't raped. She wasn't beaten. She just was strangled.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
That was enough.
Not a good way to put it.
Not a good thing.
I don't know who else could have done it.
Right. Well, we don't. But it could have been random. Could have been Brad.
Okay.
Or someone really smart got away with it and nobody has a clue.
Yeah.
But if Brad did do it, I guess he's getting off easy with 12 years.
I guess so.
And I think that wraps it up for today. It was an interesting case. I'm glad we talked about it, even though we didn't really figure out anything new. I tend to think that he really was not treated fairly by the justice system, but I can't say that I'm totally on board with justice for Brad. I don't know that he's innocent.
I agree. I think that's the best we can do with this.
Well, that's funny, because we were going to start out going against each other. I said he didn't do it. You said he did.
Right.
We went down to the end of the bar. We talked about it.
And we're both in the middle.
Yeah. So I think that world leaders need to go down to the end of a bar and talk, and maybe we could work out a lot of our problems in the world just by sharing a beer and talking. Worked for us.
It worked for us.
So if you want any more information on this case, if it interests you, there is a Dateline episode, which I watched and enjoyed. It was called The Day She Disappeared, and it's with Keith Morrison, one of our favorite Dateline hosts. He has a great way with words.
Got that voice.
Yeah, and you can catch that on NBC.com. Also, there is a book that was written by a woman named Lynn Blanchard. It's called Framed by Google Maps, and it's available on Amazon. And you can tell from the title whose side she's on. I think with Dateline, you get a little more of a unbiased. You watched Dateline, right?
I did.
Was that unbiased to you? It was a little...
It was more unbiased than the podcast I heard from the author of the book.
Mm-hmm. But what did you think about the family? Did you think that it mostly talked to her family? I didn't hear anything from... Did we hear anything from Brad's family or supporters?
No, it was...
Yeah.
It was mostly her family.
So probably if you watch the Dateline, you read the book, or the podcast was on Generation Y, if you just want to listen to the podcast where they interview her.
It was a very compelling interview.
Yeah, so I think if you watch the Dateline, you read the book, or listen to the interview, you're getting both sides.
Yes.
And if you're starting to think that Brad needs justice, then you can also look up the Justice for Brad and read a little bit more about it there. So, as you know, True Crime Brewery is available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play. You can follow us on Twitter at TieGrabberPods and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TieGrabberPodcast. Our website is www.TieGrabber.com. If you'd like to help us out, click the PayPal subscribe button on our website, and you can contribute as little as $1 a month just to help us keep this ad-free. Now, you can support us also at patreon.com, and that's patreon.com/truecrimebrewery. If you want to help the podcast without giving up any cash, it would be a really big help if you would leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps us. That's the main way that we get more listeners to listen and spread the word about our podcast. So that's it for today. I'm Jill.
I'm Dick.
See you later.
Next time.